Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Hardman, registration number 37922. I represent Floyd Noose. Mr. Noose has several strong arguments in his case, but I plan to focus our discussion this morning on the no duty to retreat instruction. But if this court has questions about the other issues, I'm more than happy to address them.
Let's stop the clock for just a minute. Okay, I heard a noise behind me, okay. So I don't mean to do any, but I'm gonna go check real quick just to see if that was Judge Monica's. So even though I think I hear a noise next time, I'm gonna ignore it. Tang. And what I was just informed by the deputy clerk report, court of the clerk, is that Judge Plank is available to sit in now. He has not read the briefs, so he would be hearing the argument cold, would then go back and read the briefs. So as a courtesy to both sides that are already out here, I'll give you the option. Do you want to just go ahead and go forward with Judge Monica is listening later?
That's fine with me.
Yes. Okay, that's how we'll proceed then. And I apologize for the delay. As I say, I'll ignore whatever sounds I hear. Please, Ms. Harvey. You may proceed.
Okay. So I'm happy to answer any questions about any of the issues if you have other concerns, but I'm going to focus our discussion on the no duty to retreat issue. In Colorado, a person who is not an initial aggressor has no duty to retreat before using force in self-defense. In cases where the jury could reasonably conclude that the defendant had a duty to retreat before using force in self-defense, the defendant is entitled to a self-defense instruction tailored to the issue of retreat.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Hardman, but I want to make sure of what our standard here is. Counsel for your client did not ask for such an instruction. Is that correct?
That's correct. And this isn't the typical case where I'm saying there wasn't an instruction, because there was an instruction. It's the placement of the instruction here that is the problem. But he did not object to the placement of the instruction, so it's plain error review.
Thank you.
Yes. The importance of having a no duty to retreat instruction is that the jury could consider the defendant's use of force unreasonable in light of the possibility of retreat. And in cases like this one, where the jury is instructed on not ordinary physical force, but deadly physical force, the no duty to retreat instruction is especially important because a defendant may only use deadly physical force if a lesser degree of force is inadequate. And the jury might conclude that because the defendant had this retreat available, his use of force would be unreasonable. Our Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the standard self-defense instruction does not cover the concept of no retreat. Here, the evidence in this case raised the issue of retreat because as Mr. Colloy was advancing into the house and coming towards Mr. Nuss, Mr. Nuss was standing in the front of a hallway, which led to two bedrooms. And then to his other side was the kitchen and the back door through which he could have retreated. And in fact, the prosecutor argued in closing argument that there were a lot of things that could have been done prior to the shooting if it's truly a person in fear. As I said...
Didn't the prosecutor at that point, though, refer to the use of a cell phone? It wasn't like the prosecutor said he could have run out the door.
He referred to a few things. He gave a few options. He said he could have used the phone. He could have... He could have used the phone. He could have called out to the roommate. He could have turned on the lights, but he didn't do those things. And
but there was no statement that he could have run away.
Well, surely the prosecutor knows not to use the word retreat.
But that may be important, don't you think? Because if the prosecutor's argument is, here are things that he could have done. He could have called the police. He could have illuminated the room. He could have talked to the person. But does not say he could have run outside. Then it's not as if the prosecutor injects the issue of retreat. He is talking about things that would happen without your client going anywhere, right?
He is injecting the issue of retreat. He's saying there are a lot of things. He's leaving that open, and he's giving a list of things that could have done. He's not saying those are the only things that could have happened, but he's saying he could have done a lot of things. Just like the prosecutor in Cassell's argument argued that the defendant made a conscious decision to return to the living room. And he observed that the victim didn't follow him into the room. And our Supreme Court found that that was enough of an argument inferring retreat. And here, I think the prosecutor's argument is even stronger. There are a lot of things Mr. Noose could have done. And he's standing there with lots of options, just like in Cassell's. I think the facts of this case are similar to Cassell's, in that you have two roommates fighting in their home, and you have the defendant's bedroom right behind him and the kitchen and the back door to the other side. And I don't think his list of options is all-inclusive. And, you know, there are, as he said, a lot of things that Mr. Noose could have done before using force in self-defense.
So... specifically, what evidence in this case raised the issue?
As Mr. Kohler is advancing on Mr. Noose, Mr. Noose is standing in the hallway. His house is laid out such that there is a small hallway that leads to two bedrooms, and it comes out into a living room. And then on the other side of that hallway is the entrance to the kitchen, and through there is the back door. And so as Mr. Kohler is advancing on him, he is standing there with the availability of retreat available to him. And so the problem here is the placement of that. Do you still have more questions about that?
No, I'm not sure that I agree that with you that raises the evidence to the level of retreat. That's why I was trying to...
Well, it's like in Cassell's. In Cassell's, Mr. Cassell's and his roommate were fighting in their apartment. And behind him was his bedroom. And in front of him was, even on the other side of the victim, was the front door. And our Supreme Court determined that that raised the issue of retreat. Because the jury could find his use of force unreasonable in light of the available retreat options. Instead of using, you see in voir dire a lot of times jurors saying, well, I don't think people should be using self-defense if they could run away. And it's that risk that makes the no duty to retreat instruction so important, that the risk that the jurors will think that so important. And here, Mr. Noose, not only like in Cassell's, when I was reading Cassell's, I was thinking, well, the door is on the other side of the victim. How is the person who was, you know, fighting with Mr. Cassell's is on the other side? How could that be retreat? But he also had his bedroom behind him. But here, Mr. Noose had the hallway and bedrooms behind on this side of him. But on the other side, he also had the back door and could have retreated. In thinking of others, like in Garcia, Manuela Garcia was lying in her bed and her husband was attacking her. And our Supreme Court found that because that raised the issue of retreat, because she, before killing him, she didn't try to first escape.
Well, if I may, how does this fit in with plain error? I mean, we don't have defense counsel saying, well, Your Honor, we need an instruction dealing with this directly on this point right now. And so you're saying that the court should have figured it out on its own. And when no one, I understand your argument about what the prosecutor had to say, but I don't know that I'm entirely convinced that that statement is the same as the statement in Cassell's. Because in Cassell's, you actually had defendant movement. But
because why, I'm sorry?
Because in Cassell's, you had some reference to defendant movement. Here, the prosecutor's argument doesn't say anything about the defendant moving. And so I'm wondering, how can we expect a judge in this circumstance, when defense counsel doesn't alert the judge, to say, okay, you haven't asked for this. You haven't told me that you know, you want this no duty to retreat thing. Why should we expect a judge in these circumstances to do this sua sponte?
I think under that reasoning, no one could ever argue plain error. Here, the court should have realized that the placement of the not placing the no duty to retreat instruction in the second degree murder instruction was error, because the law in this area is so clear and undisputed. Our Supreme Court has found that the standard self-defense instruction does not cover the concept of no duty to retreat. The court should have been aware of this. The court and this error affected his right to claim self-defense in this case.
Well, but at this point, you're suggesting that the judge be telepathic. Because as you know, as attorneys sit in trial, they make decisions all the time about what issues to raise and what issues not to raise. Plain error is a really high burden because of that problem. Because we don't know whether defense counsel intentionally decided to let this run or not. We don't know this. And I'm not suggesting that defense counsel was doing anything wrong. But that's the issue about plain error. Plain error is, this is a high burden for you. And it's a high burden for an important reason, because you know, points need to be made at trial when they matter, where issues can be corrected right away.
It is a high burden. I don't think there's any strategic reason why a trial attorney would want this, because it is so wrong and it is so fundamental and so important. Now I'm getting upset about it because I think it's so important. And defense counsel here in the comments, when they're talking about this instruction 17, which is the one about reckless manslaughter, his focus was on, they were talking about, the court knows how confusing the relationship between self-defense as an affirmative defense to murder and a regular defense to reckless manslaughter has been. And his focus was on that, and the discussion was about how they should be instructed on self-defense with respect to manslaughter. And I think this was just an oversight. But I think that this law is very obvious and very plain and very important, and affected Mr. Nuss's right to claim self-defense. I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Oh, good morning, Your Honors. Let me put this a little higher. Carmen Morales, representing the people. My attorney registration is 34852. I disagree with defense counsel that the no duty to retreat instructions was warranted. As you said, defense counsel did not request a duty to retreat. And second of all, the facts of this case did not raise the issue, nor did the circumstances gave rise to an inference that Mr. Nuss could have retreated.
On to, he was asked twice by myself and my colleague, what evidence there was of a duty to retreat. You heard her response. Can you respond to that?
What evidence there was of a duty to retreat? There was...
Or no evidence, I guess, is what you would be arguing.
There was no evidence that... The facts did not raise the issue. The dynamics of the incident were kind of pretty quick. Mr. Nass heard a rattling noise at the door. He got up. He came out of the room, heard someone trying to break in, and then saw this person, the person coming in. He said, stop. The person, the victim, did not respond, did not say anything. He shot in the head. The victim turned to one side. He shot again. That's it. This case is very different from Cassell's. Cassell's, we have a very different situation where defendant was in the shower. The victim came in. The victim was threatening. The victim was saying, I want to fight. Defendant said, I don't want to fight. The victim actually was shoving the defendant. The victim at some point was following defendant from the bedroom to the living room. He positioned himself next to an iron bar that he had previously said could make a good weapon. At that point, the defendant went to his bedroom and retrieved a loaded gun, and then decided to come out to the bedroom, to the living room where the victim was, and shot him 9 times. So the Supreme Court there said the fact that the defendant kind of created an opportunity to barricade himself in his bedroom and lock the door, and decided the jury could have well reasonably concluded that, again, he created the opportunity, he could have retreated and be safe, and instead decided to come out. And in that case, the prosecution argued the defendant made a deliberate choice to go to his bedroom, retrieve a gun, and made a deliberate choice to come out of the bedroom, come back to the living room, and shot the defendant. So the circumstance of the case gave rise to an inference that he could have retreated, stay in the bedroom, lock the door, instead decided to come out and go with the victim. Well, we don't have that situation here. And here, again, the dynamics were fast. There's no, nothing could have the jury make believe that he could, in fact, go and retreat himself and lock the door. It is unreasonable, it is unlikely that the facts in this case so created. And the other thing, I disagree with defense counsel that the prosecution argument kind of suggested that he has such a duty. The prosecution simply was saying that a person who is in fear, would have done something different. And he specifically referred to the fact that there was a phone. He said, what about that phone at the foot of the bed? What about that phone? He could have called the police if he was in fear. There is not a suggestion that he could have retreated. It's a suggestion that this is not, he was in fear, this is not self-defense, he knew what he was doing, he had everything planned. And again, I said, this is, as Bernard said, this is, you are reviewing for plain error. Plain error is obvious, it's substantial, it's a big thing, something that the court should have noticed. And it's definitely not so obvious and so substantial. And definitely, I don't think there was anything wrong. And the fact that there was some language in a different instruction, I don't think there were any problems, because under these facts, the jury could have believed, maybe he could have retreated himself. No, unlikely. And again, at most, it was that language was irrelevant and superfluous. Do you have any other questions on the retreat issue? I prepare for the other issues there are. If you have any questions on the suppression or the self-defense, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question for you about
and the custodial. Your position that he was not in custody?
Yes, Your Honor.
At the time?
Uh-huh.
Now, the defendant, was at the jail being photographed, tested. He had changed into a department jumpsuit,
mm-hmm.
and was asked to wait in the interviewing room. He was driven to the station by the police.
Mm-hmm.
Under the totality of the circumstances, isn't that custody? I don't see how you take the position it's not.
I think that he was, I mean, I think there is enough in the record to support a determination that he was not in custody. And again, up until the time he was read, it was not until after he was read his rights that these two detectives learned that they were investigating a home intrusion, not really a homicide. The defendant voluntarily agreed to go with the detectives. He voluntarily agreed to get all the DNA tests. At no point, he wasn't handcuffed. The detectives, I believe, no weapons were drawn. So everything, he seemed to be in a good mental condition. Nothing seemed to be, again, everything was voluntary. And it's true, the detective told the defendant that he did not have to submit to those tests if he didn't want to. That was his right. And the defendant agreed.
But at one point, he's not in his own clothes anymore. He's in a department jumpsuit. Now, doesn't that suggest more of custody than what you've already talked about?
Well, that's another factor to consider, but I think under the totality of the circumstances, that's just one thing. You have to look at everything, not just that, the fact that he was in the jumpsuit. So, again, it's just not one thing, it's all of it. And I think it weighs against a custody determination. But even if this court disagrees, he wasn't interrogated until the time he was read his rights.
With regard to the interrogation, I know there's a pre-Miranda
yes.
and a post-Miranda. Focusing on the pre-Miranda before mm-hmm. he was read his rights, he was specifically asked about the layout of the house.
Yes.
He was asked detailed questions about the tenant.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked the last time he saw the tenant and whether they were good friends or pretty good friends. Why isn't that interrogation?
Oh, so if we look at the last question were you pretty good friends? And that was, if I well remember, that the last question right before he was read his rights.
It was before he was read his rights.
Just before he was right, he's right. You're correct, Your Honor. But if you look at all the questioning, and again, it's all historical background information, first about the defendant, and then where they ask him, how about the layout of your house? Judy Valoni, he said, there's a guy in the basement. So at that time, kind of to continue the investigation, they asked a specific question about the tenant, what's his name, address, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, it's true that at the very end, they asked, are you pretty good friends? But I don't think, and right after that, the police jump and read it right. I don't think that just that question was likely to elicit an incriminating response, because at that time, the police did not know that the relationship between the defendant and the victim was not that good, and did not know that the defendant was trying to evict the victim. And it's true that this is you look at under a reasonableness standard, but what the police knew or what they thought, I think, is relevant evidence, because it goes or it bears on whether he should have reasonably believed that that question could elicit an incriminating response. So looking at the entire questioning, I don't think there was interrogation. Again, even that question, were you pretty good friends, was not likely to elicit an incriminating response.
So why don't you think we have a Siebert problem?
Why a Siebert problem? I think Siebert is very, again, I'm not to say narrow particular. In Siebert, you have pre-Miranda interrogation where they extract a confession. And then they give the defendant a break, and then they read the rights and do it, go essentially through the same kind of interrogation, the same questioning, and then extract a second confession. So the concern there is that once you have a defendant who has confessed and then is read his rights midstream, might be a reasonable person in that situation might think, I just confess, whether they really have a real choice, whether they retain a choice to stop questioning, or whether the effectiveness of those rights. So that's the concern here. We don't have a confession. nothing close to a confession. And again, my position is that he was not interrogated. And again, if you see the questioning pre-Miranda and what happened after Miranda, it's very different. It's essentially different. Pre-Miranda is a historical background. After Miranda, it's so more focused. What did you do this morning when you got up until the time of the shooting? So it's very, very, it's substantially different. So that's why I think we don't have a Siebert case, because first of all, we don't even have a confession to start with. Does that answer your question, Jenna? Any other questions? Okay. I request that the defendant's conviction be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
I'd like to try to make 3 points very quickly. First of all, the evidence in Casals of the fight was much longer. It was a much longer fight. But the evidence here in this case still raised the issue of self-defense. He was still instructed on self-defense. And once he gets a self-defense instruction, he should be receive correct instructions on self-defense. These instructions were not correct. Second, your question earlier about the comment in Casals, you said that it focused on the defendant's movement, but really it didn't. It was the defendant's decision making, saying that he. Now I forgot, and I don't know what I did with my notes. But it's the defendant's decision making, and here the defendant's. The comment was also about defendant's decisions. What could he do? He had a lot of options available to him, but instead he chose to defend himself. And that is his right. He does not have to retreat. He does not have to do all the other things, but he does not have to retreat before acting in self-defense. And I want to stress that the problem here is much greater than just not receiving a no duty to retreat instruction, but here the placement of the no duty to retreat instruction in the reckless manslaughter self-defense instruction implied that with respect to second degree murder, there was a duty to retreat. And that I think is even a worse problem than just not receiving one. The comment in Casals was that defendant made a conscious decision to stay where he was. And then the comment was that the victim didn't follow defendant. But here it was that there are a lot of things that Mr. Noose could have done before acting in defense, which I think is the same or worse. If this court has no further questions, I would ask that you reverse Mr. Noose's conviction and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, both for your excellence. And for the record, there were two of us who sat in on this case. The third judge, Judge Marquez, will go back and listen to the tapes. I know he's already read the briefs, and he will then be included in the conference that we'll have in deciding the case. And an opinion will issue in due course.